I want to talk today, since it's a very broad topic, having to do with both Marx's philosophy and economics. What I thought I would concentrate on is first to describe certain aspects of Marx's philosophy, in particular what he thought the proper method was of studying philosophy, the proper method of study that he then applied to economic theory. That's to say, the very distinctive kind of economics that Marx attempted in his works is, to some extent at least, conditioned by his philosophy. So I'll first begin with some brief comments on the philosophical background. Now, an unfortunate feature of doing that is that it requires first saying something about Hegel, who, if as anyone who's looked at Hegel will know, isn't the easiest philosopher to understand. Some of this will be dealt with by Professor Rothbard, particularly on certain parallels between Hegel and Marx and various religious views, so I'll avoid going into that in any detail. But what I wanted to concentrate on, particularly in Hegel, that influenced Marx a great deal, was I think we can see by best grasp by looking at a famous statement of Hegel, in which he says, "What is rational is actual, and what is actual is rational." Now, this seems like a very counterintuitive idea, that it seems to be suggesting that there's some rationality or some reason for everything that takes place in the world, and it seems that that's very much counterintuitive. There doesn't seem, say, to be any connection between my speaking here today and Napoleon's loss of the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. So how can it be that what's rational is actual and what's actual is rational? But Hegel didn't mean anything like that at all. In fact, there was one critic of Hegel, a minor German philosopher at the time, who said, "Well, if you think everything is rational, could you deduce the existence of my pen right now?" And Hegel dismissed that as really not understanding what he meant. What he meant was, first, we can get a preliminary idea if we look, say, at any scientific theory, that in any scientific theory, one is unifying things that appear not to be unified at first, but it's not that actual objects as we see them are unified, it's just in some way things, as it were, below the surface that are connected up and are rational. So when he's saying what is actual is rational, what the actual refers to there is not sort of the sense world. He says in the Phenomenology, he talks about what he calls the level of sense certainty, which is the world as we see it, just as we're looking at it. And this is dismissed very early as not giving us a very good idea of what things are really like. So far we have that there's a unification of things in the sense that a scientific theory unifies things below the surface. So that's at least gives a preliminary grasp of what he meant by saying what is rational is actual, what is actual is rational. But this is only the preliminary part of what Hegel meant and what Marx took over from him. Hegel thought that the kind of unification that you get in a scientific theory is just a very inferior sort. It was all right as far as it went, but it really wasn't all that much. And you can get his views on science in what's probably his least read work of his major works, the second part of the encyclopedia called The Philosophy of Nature. If you look at it, you'll see why it's the least often read part. But he makes clear there that he thinks that science isn't really unifying things in a correct way, or it's just a sort of, it's really leaving a lot of things not tightly connected enough. He thinks that, say, in a scientific theory, you're saying, for example, say that certain particles are attracting each other with a gravitational force. Well, this is might be true, but it leaves everything else about those particles unexplained. It just says they attract each other in this way, but it doesn't explain every relation of the particles. So he thought that really everything was tightly unified. This is sometimes referred to as a doctrine of internal relations, that sort of, it isn't that things are just externally connected with each other, accidentally connected, sort of everything is very tightly connected, so that if anything were to change, everything else would be different at the same time. Now, that, however, still doesn't give the full measure of what he thought was the real unity of the world. Now, we very often think, say, of a scientific hypothesis or a law as something that people come up with or think about and then try to see whether test in the actual world and see if it comes true or not, or see if it's false. But Hegel thought that that wasn't really what's involved, or that, again, is only true at a very lower level of things. He thought, and this is the peculiar part of his doctrine, which I think is the most difficult to grasp, that logic is something that is not an idea in people's minds, but is something actually present, actually out in the world. That if you look at his greatest work on metaphysics, it's called Logic, and it isn't this book about thinking, it's about developments of concepts where those are thought to be actual things in the world, actual, that combine both universal and particular qualities. It's sort of, logic is not an idea people have, it's an actual, it's the actual world developing. You might think of this, some people think this is somewhat of a idea of sort of a theological idea, it's sort of God's mind is working itself out, but that isn't strictly right, because the concept or idea is only conscious or self-conscious at certain stages, not throughout the whole system. But he still thinks even if the idea isn't conscious, it's still out there, it's still real. I shouldn't say out there in the sense of physically out there, because that physical reality is just part of this progression of a logic. Now this is, as you can see, is a quite difficult doctrine to grasp, but what's important here is that influenced Marx is just this idea of the there being an actual development of something in the world. You know, that a theory isn't just something that people construct and then try to see whether it's true or not. A correct theory has to actually be part of the world operating. And as we'll see when I get to Marx's labor theory of value, we'll see exactly how this idea comes in. But unfortunately, we haven't finished with Hegel yet. But fortunately, that part, the notion of the absolute idea or concept working in the world, is the most difficult part of the part of Hegel I'll be discussing. But another aspect I want to mention of Hegel's thought that very much affected the way Marx developed his economics and social theory is a view that Hegel held of ethics. Now, if you look at any of the, most of the great philosophers, they have books that are called Ethics, where they talk about standard ethical problems, say, on how one derives various moral rules or what the virtues are, and so on. Hegel doesn't do that, because he rejected the idea of ethical rules as something that is apart from the actual world. This, again, wouldn't be tightly unified enough. We would be having rules and then facts, which the rules are supposed to apply to, but there wouldn't be any real connection between the two. People might just not observe these rules, and then the connection between the rules and the facts would be accidental, whether people followed the ethical prescriptions or not. So Hegel's ethics, such as they are in fact, found in his work, The Philosophy of Right, which could also be translated Philosophy of Law. He thought that ethics wasn't a matter of universal prescriptions, or to the extent it was, that was just of relatively minor significance, but that ethics could only be viewed as part of political life, just as Aristotle had his ethics connected with his politics. Hegel thought that one could only talk about ethics within a certain social system that was constituted by a state, so that unless you have a sort of a concrete society, you're not talking about what the really highest basis of law. It's a mistake, and he particularly criticized Immanuel Kant for this, to try to view ethics as apart from politics. And Marx, as we'll see, took up this idea very much, that he tended to dismiss rights and in his own thought very much along these lines as sort of very abstract concepts that weren't worth much. For example, in one note that Marx wrote on Bentham, he mentions Bentham's principle, the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Actually, Bentham had that principle only at one stage in his career, but Marx didn't deal with that. But he says about this principle, he said, well, this doesn't tell us very much. It's just sort of a general statement that doesn't lead anywhere. We can only understand this if it's viewed and it's how it's applied in a particular setting, in a particular social system. So we can see this Hegelian point that ethics doesn't come in unless it's viewed in this concrete way. Now, that is the second part of Hegel's views that I think I wanted to mention. There's one other point, and this one Marx both was influenced by and reacted to some extent against. Hegel thought that although the function of the philosopher was to show that the rationality of things, or show, as I put it, the development of the absolute idea, this could only be attempted for what had already been shown to exist. One couldn't deduce what was going to happen in the future, because that again would be a separation of abstract ideas from events, since the events aren't around yet. If we try to deduce them, we just have certain abstract premises. We wouldn't have a full, what he calls a concrete universal, the perfect unification of concepts and facts. So remember in the famous preface in the Philosophy of Right, he describes sort of philosophy painting what he calls its gray and gray, and then he said, that concludes with the beautiful line, the owl of Minerva takes wing only with the coming of dusk. The owl of Minerva is the sort of a symbol of philosophy, and he's saying you can only have philosophical explanations of the course of the world after they've taken place. He's denying that one can predict the future. He occasionally did speculate himself on future developments. For example, he thought the United States would be very important in future, but this is not really part of his system. So where this both influenced Marx and got him into trouble is that Marx wanted very explicitly to advocate a certain type of system, socialism or communism, but he was very much influenced by the Hegelian views that you can't say what's going to happen in the future. So we can see here one reason that he didn't specify in any detail what communist society would be like. This would be going against the method of what Hegel thought was a proper method of studying logic. I should say, I'm by no means contending that Marx was a disciple of Hegel, but he did study the logic throughout his life, not only in the 1840s, in the famous 1844 manuscripts, but he wrote, in the few years before that, he wrote two commentaries, in one of which is a paragraph-by-paragraph commentary on Hegel's Philosophy of Right, and then just before he wrote Das Kapital, he made a very detailed study of Hegel's logic. So we can see this method that I've been talking about, it sounds rather obscure, but it's a very essential part of what influenced Marx. But when I talked about Marx's philosophical background, it's a mistake to think of Marx as just influenced by Hegel and no one else. We also have to recall that Marx was, after was a materialist, and here most people mention just Ludwig Feuerbach, who criticized religion or viewed religion as sort of just projections of people's of sort of ideal human beings onto the world, and he accordingly dismissed Hegel's some of Hegel's theological speculations as mystification. But the real, I think, more important influence on Marx was more from the Greek materialists. You know, if you look at Marx's doctoral dissertation, it's a comparison of the systems Democritus and Epicurus. What is, the significance there is not in particular points on their particular points of doctrine, but sort of a basic idea of materialism that, as the Greeks practice it, which is again similar in one way to Hegel, that you're, in their view, you were looking for an underlying level of things, saying the system of Democritus, what really goes on is in the world is not what we see on the surface, just various physical objects, but movements of material particles of various kinds. So just like with Hegel thought, was saying that there's sort of a real level that is different from the level of sense certainty, the Greek materialists were also looking for an underlying level. And here what was important to Marx was that the underlying level has to be material. This is not something that Hegel thought. He thought that material reality was just one part of the progress of the absolute idea, but that Marx took over from the materialist that you have to explain things in terms of material forces, not just ideas, whether you view them as objective ideas or whatever, but it has to be material forces. And he combined this with Hegel's view of the concept developing by itself. So what he got was it's material forces that have to be developing by themselves within history or within the world. You see how if you just took from the Greek materialists, you wouldn't get this. You would just have, you're looking for material forces, but you don't get the dynamic aspect till you put in the part from Hegel. It's combining the two that gives you for the real essence of Marx's approach there. So far we have then this, we'll now shortly see how Marx concretely applied this in his economic social theory. But there's one further fact that I think one has to take account in looking at Marx's philosophy, and this has put him in some difficulties with the Hegelian system. I've referred to it very briefly before, and this is namely that Marx was, during the great part of his life, a professional revolutionary. He was interested in changing the world in a certain direction, not just in studying it. As he says in one of his famous theses on Feuerbach, this disciple of Hegel, criticized religion I mentioned before, he says, the philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. And this was, Marx wrote this when he was quite young, but they were published as an appendix, these theses were published as an appendix to Engels' work, Ludwig Feuerbach, The End of Classical German Philosophy, and so they became known after that. But you see how this gets Marx into some difficulties with his Hegelian method, that he's both saying, he wants to both apply Hegel's method, which is you have to study the world as it actually has come to pass and show the rationality of it, again taken in this materialist way, showing material forces as having done this, but he also wants to change things as well. So this got him into quite a few difficulties. But before getting to in more detail how this got him into difficulties, I think we can now turn to how in his economic system he applied this type of method I've been briefly and inadequately sketching. Now, probably the most famous part of Marx's economics is the labor theory of value. Here, this is the notion that commodities exchange according to the socially less necessary labor time contained in each, required to produce each one. There's some dispute as to whether he meant the socially necessary labor that has produced each one or the socially necessary labor that would be necessary to produce each one, but I won't go into that dispute right now. If people want to raise it in the discussion, perhaps we can. But one problem here, which Marx was fully aware of, is that commodities in the world don't exchange according to socially necessary labor time embodied in each one. Why then did he have a model in which they did? Well, we can see here just this notion I've been talking about of an underlying structure of things, or an underlying explanation of things. Marx thought that just to describe the world as it, say the world of economic exchange as it actually appeared, wouldn't be penetrating to the essence of things. To really understand things, one had to go beneath the surface in the way I've just tried to describe both the Hegel and, in a different way, the Greek materialist did. So that he thought the labor type of the exchange of labor in the way I've just described was what was really taking place beneath the surface of the economy, explaining it, and that was modified in certain ways in the world as we see it, in the economic world as we see it, but this was actually going on explaining and accounting for the world. I think it's important here to see that the argument is sometimes given, say, by Sowell has this in his 1985 book on Marx, and he said, well, the various refutations of labor theory aren't really that important because Marx was just giving this as a model of what happened. Well, this is just taking, wrongly taking a theory in the way it's taken by certain scientists, as sort of just an idea that the theorist has, it's tested against the world. It ignores Marx's method, where the theory is not just an idea he had, but it's supposed to actually be there underlying things. Unless it, one can argue for it, one doesn't have a correct account of things according to Marx. Now, just briefly describing what he had in mind in the labor theory, when he said that things exchange according to the socially necessary labor time in each one, we have to understand that he's meaning an equality here in a very strict sense. As you know, there's a standard Austrian refutation of his view, which is that when people exchange, they're trading only, they'll trade only if each person values what he's giving up less than what he's getting, so that you have a double inequality rather than equality. Now, Marx would have, he didn't explicitly consider that account of things, since, of course, utility theory hadn't been developed when he was writing. But one can be sure he would have said that's just an explanation at the surface level. This is just what people appear to be doing in the world as we know it. It isn't penetrating below the surface to get what he calls the laws of motion, or the law of motion of capitalism, which he thought that this materialist method and Hegelian method was really what underlies science as well. He thought that Galileo and Newton had applied just the style of method he had gotten from Hegel as modified in a materialist way. So he would have no doubt replied that this to really understand what's going beneath the surface, you have to have his account of things. And as I was suggesting, he takes this equality in a very strict way. He takes it as an equation where the two things that are exchanged are identical in some way. that say they contain a certain common substance, namely socially necessary labor, that has to be the same in both commodities. So then when he later, as probably I think another lecture is going to deal with this, he gets into difficulties, he tries to come up with some elaborate explanation of how real world prices are derived from this, that most economists since the time of von Bawerk have said doesn't work. But you see, even if he were able to show that it did work, it would only be acceptable if you first agreed with him that there was this underlying level of things that's actually present in the world. It seemed like even if he had succeeded in showing how prices could be derived from labor exchange in a certain way, that would have only been to extricate himself from a difficulty of his own devising. It's because he was looking at things from the point of view of this particular view of method that he got into the problem in the first place. Now, one can see this notion not only of a sort of underlying level, not only in the labor theory, but in his whole system of economics and social thought. Again, in explaining the development of history, culminating in the, as he thought, replacement of capitalism by socialism, one has to follow his method, explain things by material forces. Here, what was important to him was the so-called forces of production, which is pretty much, very roughly, equivalent to the technology that existed at a particular time. And he saw this as constantly increasing throughout history and bringing about in its wake changes of the social system. It wasn't people's ideas that changed things. This would be violating proper materialist method, but it was more the development of the material forces in itself that explain things. As he says in his 1858 critique of political economy, it is not the consciousness of people that determines their being, meaning their social being, but their being that determines their consciousness. So what was going on in the world, the development of forces of production, really explained the whole of history. You see, again, he thought, when particularly this was applied to capitalism, from his labor theory, he applied this to get an explanation of profit, which he thought he could show necessarily arose from the sort of a way in which labor was purchased. I won't go into the technical details of the thing because I think they don't work even accepting Marx's theory is correct. I don't think his argument works there, but I think that would probably be... I don't have the argument clearly enough in my mind to be able to present it in a simple enough way, which indicates I don't understand it thoroughly enough, but I'm fairly certain that he's wrong in that respect. But in any event, he thought that this was what explained how capitalism develops in the world, and how the sort of the general principle of development of forces of production took place under capitalism by the capitalists exploiting the workers through this kind of trick, and there would be a constant struggle to increase the forces of production. Each one would be trying to increase his profit, and even though Marx thought this would lead to constant crises in the eventual replacement of capitalism by socialism. Now, you can see how this generates a problem for something I'd earlier mentioned, namely, according to this Hegelian method, you can only describe things as they've actually taken place. So how could Marx talk about what was going to happen in the future, namely the rise of socialism? Well, Marx had a way of attempting to get around this. He thought that when he was describing the onset of socialism, this was not something that was coming really in the future, but it was just a description or a brief extension of the present. He has in Das Kapital the famous statement the integument of the old order bursts. That's to say, all the forces of production are developed to the fullest extent possible under capitalism, and then socialism would then automatically come about, since it's the development of the forces of production based on this materialist way of understanding things that explains history, taking, again, this materialist explanation in combined with Hegel's view of dynamics of things, a concept operating by its dynamically. So in looking at this just briefly, we can see some problems in it other than, of course, resting on the Hegelian method, which isn't very well argued for. When Marx has to assume that each system that develops throughout history is the most productive system possible at that time, but one wonders, why is that the case? Say, wouldn't it have been more productive had capitalism come about at the time of feudalism? Marx has to think that at the time the feudal system arose, that was the most productive system possible. And it certainly doesn't seem to be the case. Why should one think that? Even if it was more productive than whatever the previous system was, how does that show it was the most productive system possible, which his theory requires? Then, if one brings in the famous calculation argument of Mises, socialism isn't a possible system at all. It would lead, it produce attempts to realize it would only if taken in a full-scale way where the economy wouldn't be dependent on capitalist pricing, would simply produce economic chaos. So if Marx is right that the forces of production, development of forces of production determines history, that would seem like be an argument in favor of capitalism or the permanence of capitalism rather than socialism. Now, and the final point on Marx's account, which is one that was raised with great effect by Mises in his work Theory and History, which I think is the best account of Marx's views of history. It's the best analysis of Marxism that for the aspects of that system that don't aren't strictly to do with economics. Mises pointed out that Marx just assumes these forces are developing themselves. Again, he's relying on this Hegelian method of just things developing by themselves. It isn't that people are thinking of new methods and kind of always trying to increase things. It's they have an independent force. And unless you take the Hegelian idea seriously of some sort of logic in the world, this doesn't seem to make much sense. So we can see there are a lot of problems in Marx's account of things, that he's been in some sense the prisoner of his method. Now, to conclude, I'd like to say a few words on a topic some of the previous speakers were commenting on this morning, on what type of system Marx wanted in the future, and particularly, as one might expect by now, how the philosophical method he had absorbed from Hegel and the materialists influenced what he thought. I mean, here, the controversy that many people have, that been discussed by many people, is to what extent did, if any, did Marx want a so-called democratic socialism, or one consistent with people having liberty? Didn't he seem to portray communism or socialism as a liberation of people? Well, here I think one has to focus on what he called the dictatorship of the proletariat, which would be the initial rule after the overthrow of capitalism. This sounds like, when you first look at it, a rather contradictory phrase, in that a dictatorship is taken to be a one-man rule, so how could you have a whole class being a dictator? But to understand this, one has to see that as used in the 19th century, dictatorship didn't mean one-man rule, something, say, the way we'd say Stalin or Hitler was a dictator. What it meant was something derived from Roman law, which, of course, Marx had studied when he was in college, which is a temporary delegation of power to someone on an emergency basis in which the laws that exist are temporary or suspended while the whoever is given the delegation can deal with things on an emergency basis. So by dictatorship of the proletariat, it really means a system in which the proletariat class is crushing all the opposition. It's dealing with things in emergency basis that Marx, I think, correctly thought there'd be a lot of opposition from capitalists if socialism were ever put into power. And he thought this was the period in which they'd crush the opposition. He's quite explicit about that in many places, talking about revolutionary terrorism. So that we can see just from the use of that phrase that it's hardly a system of civil liberties that he has in mind. But to turn more directly to the theme of my lecture, one can see that given his views on the way history worked, he wasn't one to stress liberties at all, not necessarily because he favored a system of arbitrary rule, but because he didn't think abstract ideas such as statements of universal rights were of any importance. What's important, remember, is the underlying material level of things. These are just verbal formulas that don't account for things that really are unimportant, so it's hardly likely he was going to put much stress on them in the actual development of his social ideas, and in fact, he didn't. So that I think one can see just from his method in itself that it's very unlikely that he favored any sort of democratic order. It just wasn't an issue of importance to him. And on one occasion, when one of the resolutions of the International Working Men's Association had a formula about rights, he said in a letter to Engels, he's managed to take out most of this nonsense. This really didn't concern him much. A final point I make there. Now, some people point out that, well, didn't Marx say that at least in some countries in Western Europe there might be a possibility for bringing in socialism just by people voting it in? But he did make a few statements like that, but the important thing is not how socialism would come in, but what happens once it is in. And there his position, that of Engels, was always that there would be considerable opposition that one would have to crush by drastic means. And one can see from the description I've given of his philosophical method, this was very much what one would expect him to say. So in conclusion, what I've tried to do in this talk is give a brief account of Marx's philosophical background is derived from both Hegel and the Greek materialists, and try to give a few topics in which this method is used in his economics and account of history, and how it to a large extent constricted his views and led him into error, and often dangerous error. Thank you.